Senate Bill...
I've got it here.
Senate Bill 845 will be rescheduled.
It's on the back page, sure.
Senate Bill 550 and 551 will be rescheduled for the 22nd, and if they were not ready to go, they will be gone.
Ooh, yeah.
Senate Bill, what are we going to do with that?
We're not hearing it.
Yeah, okay. Senate Bill 552 has actually been incorporated into 551, so that is will not be heard at all, 552. We will hear a work session on Senate Bill 735. We are going to carry over Senate Bill 646 because we do have the amendment but not the fiscal. And Senate Bill 287 we are going to carry over. So that will be, these will be heard on Monday. Senate Bill 649 we will have a hearing. We can deal with that today, hearing possible work session. There is an amendment that we have, and we do have the fiscal and the revenue. And Senate Bill 716, we are going to have the public hearing because we do have a witness who came from Seattle for this bill, and we will certainly hear his expert testimony, but we will not be able to act on that bill today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think, Mr. Chair, given this is April 15th, I think it's appropriate that we have all these extensions.
And you know what happens after...
Thank you for making me feel good.
After April 15th, we have penalties. Big time. Penalties.
Not if you file the extension.
Not if you have an appropriate extension.
Oh, you have an appropriate... Very good. We just did the extension.
Very good.
Okay, so the first bill, 735, we are going to open a work session. Janine Smith, would you please come up and clarify an issue for us, please?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 735 has been heard two previous occasions, April 1st and April 13th. It modifies the provision for administrator to perform any of the functions of the Oregon Prescription Drug Program, including but not limited to contract. We do have a dash one amendment to which we've received the fiscal and revenue impact statements on that amendment.
Okay. Thank you very much. A question that has come up and will continue to come up will be the Medicaid possibility in this bill. Could you address that, please?
Senator Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Janine Smith, the administrator for the Office of Health Policy and Research, which is where the Oregon Prescription Drug Program is located. And what the dash one amendment and the bill itself does is just remove barriers to the program to be able to pursue potential opportunities, and it does not necessarily direct any one group to be looked at. It does allow the possibility of the group looking at Medicaid and seeing if partnership with Medicaid is a benefit to either the prescription drug program, which benefits the state of Oregon and Oregonians, either through its uninsured population and its groups that participate in it, and or the Medicaid agency itself. We don't say that we're necessarily going to jump to do this tomorrow. It's just that it opens that as a door, as an opportunity to look at, and we would weigh the pros and cons and discuss whether it is something that is beneficial to either the Medicaid program and or the other groups and or the uninsured that participate in the Oregon Prescription Drug Program.
Mm-hmm. Now, that has been tested in the courts, right?
Chair Morissette, yes, in Maine, there was a Supreme Court ruling in Maine that would allow them to partner with the Medicaid agency.
And that was, and I can't remember his name, but that was a former director of DHS who...
Chair Moore said, I don't remember exactly who took that case.
Yeah, well, it was interesting because...
Director of DHS, who did do quite a bit of work in Maine.
He went to Maine, and he included the Medicaid, and that went to the United States Supreme Court, and the court with upheld that move. And in fact, I remember actually watching the decision as it came over the news. We were in session, and I was watching the news that night, and it was interesting. One of the things about the OPDP program, when we instituted the program, a proponent supporter from pharma who said, well, he said, why don't you require PEB to come into OPDP? And I said, we can't do that. First of all, there are contracts. Secondly, we don't know if it would be an advantage to the state to do that, because if the program cost the state money, we wouldn't do it. And the former director of PEB, Gene Thorne, made that statement to me at one point when we were talking about PEB. She said, Bill, if it's going to cost state money, we're not going to go there. So I think that is, as far as I'm concerned, the bottom line of this program, to include a group that is not, doesn't make financial sense, particularly to the state of Oregon, that's going to cost us. In any way, we wouldn't do it.
And Chair Moore said, also the Oregon Health Fund Board in its recommendation said that, you know, they encouraged the participation and an expansion of Oregon Prescription Drug Program because of what it could accomplish, but to ensure that it was cost effective for everyone, that if a group was to come in, and not necessarily force them to come in just because, but to do it if it was cost effective.
Well, and that is, I think, there's some concern about forcing counties or cities into, you know, the Oregon Health Plan. I mean, there was part of 2009, I think, even suggests that, and that is something that has to be worked out through contractual, existing contracts, and whether or not it's beneficial. So, Senator Martin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I need you again to clarify the role of the federal government in all of this. It says, I have this letter that states, including Medicaid in the pool would make the entire program subject to federal approval and oversight. And Medicaid cannot be combined or used to leverage discounts on non-Medicaid populations without federal approval based on the criteria. I know that's one opinion. Can you address that issue?
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, I believe that was put into testimony during our hearing, and it was the way that particular state had written its state, the amendment and request to CMS. And so if we were to do anything with Medicaid, we would need to look at how it would be structured. And we can't impose people who aren't eligible for Medicaid to have benefits that would be given to people on Medicaid. So we would need to look at how to set this up so that it would be legal based on, we would not want to break any federal rules or CMS rules or anything like that if we did do any partnership with Medicaid. It's very possible we won't necessarily do anything with Medicaid. It's not sure. Now, whether there was ways to bring in more savings by, if Medicaid has a certain type of focus on trying to direct to the most efficient, best evidence drugs, and so does the rest of the pool, then we could probably, you know, bring in more rebates, etc., you know, by directing the market forces towards particular drugs. So we might want to look at whether there would be some sort of common formulary approach or something like that, but not necessarily that anything that's done in Medicaid is then imposed on the groups that are part of OPDP. No, that would not occur. And I can have Missy Dolan come up, who's the administrator, to further fill in any more details.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I don't believe, unless I missed it, did you answer about the, if you go that route, that then you have to bring in, that there is some regulation or supervision by the federal government?
Oregon would probably have to...
Go ahead and introduce
Excuse me.
Yeah.
For the record, I'm Missy Dolan, Administrator for the OPDP, and Chair Morissette and Senator Verger, members of the committee. Oregon would probably have to apply for a state plan amendment if they wanted to find any kind of synergistic relationship between Medicaid and the rest of the pool.
But it would only apply to the Medicaid population. Chair Morissette, Senator Verger, I mean, it would need to be structured in such a way that we wouldn't want to be looking for a way to have the federal government come in and oversee the rest of the program, no. But we want to make sure we would be in alignment with whatever rules and regs CMS has. And so we would need to ask permission to, if we do anything with the Medicaid program, we usually ask permission from the federal government. But it would need to be structured in such a way. The ruling you had from 2003, the structuring was wrong, and so they denied it. Maine, had, the way they were going to structure it, they're, according to their Supreme Court, that it would be allowed. So it just depends on how you structure it, which is why we would want to be some thoughtful thinking about looking at these options. Currently, the current statute prohibits us to even look. And if there's potential savings to Oregonians and tax dollars, we feel like there's an obligation to at least look. But it doesn't mean that we would necessarily go forth with anything. And if we did it, we would make sure it was done to prevent any sort of excessive federal oversight and make sure we were in alignment with federal rules and regs.
Okay. Other questions? Yes. Senator Telford.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering if the better route at this point, instead of a statutory provision to administer, would be moving forward to just exploring and then coming back to see if we need a statute that actually allows us to do this. It sounds like there's an awful lot of unanswered questions, the answers to which might change the way we rule on this bill. I'm looking more towards, I think, the committee.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
My reaction to that is it's a tool, and it would be allow them to be able to look at possibilities.
Yeah.
And the fact that they can't do it is sort of really high sidebars as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. This is a discussion that at first, I don't know if there was a must in there at all, if there ever was a must, but to open the possibility. Okay, the evolution of this bill is interesting because in 2003, we with the help of Pharma and former Senator John Minnis, we passed a bill that would allow us to include people of 54 and older, 85% of poverty. That came along at a great time because it also allowed us to fill in on the donut hole where seniors on Medicare who were in this infamous donut hole had no coverage for their drugs, and we were able to allow them to use our card and keep the receipts and get credit for out-of-pocket, which was good. So it did benefit seniors tremendously. We then it did extend it 80% support from the voters to include the uninsured, which is huge. And there was no opposition to that. None. So the program has been an excellent program to deal with the uninsured, up to 60% discount on drugs. And then we included the underinsured at a later time, meaning that if you had a copay that was higher than our card, you could use the OPDP card in place of your insurance card. Now, my insurance company denied me Celebrex at one point, which I didn't argue with, but if I had my OPDP card, I could have received Celebrex at a discount. So... Now, the goal of this program is to bring the costs down for everybody in the state of Oregon on prescription drugs. And we are partnered with the state of Washington. And the state of Idaho has been interested, and the state of Montana has been interested. So we're trying to expand the program and not necessarily mandate that we include Medicaid at all. Who knows what the new administration is going to do with Medicare and Medicaid? Things are changing. Who knows what the Oregon Health Plan will do with prescription drugs and Medicare and Medicaid. So this is an option that I think is a very important option to have at some point. And if it's beneficial to the state of Oregon, if it's beneficial to people that we serve, then we will do it. If it's not beneficial, we won't. So I think it's a fairly simple way of approaching. Senator Cruz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm confused when you say you're prohibited from exploring options. You folks have conversations with CMS all the time. So how are you prohibited from exploring possibilities?
Senator Morissette and Senator Cruz, it currently says that the Oregon Prescription Drug Program may not partner with the Medicaid program. So,
right.
So it doesn't mean we couldn't go and talk to them. It's true, but we would have to come back for statutory authority to do anything.
Right.
So, okay. So in this case, it would, but to put the time and energy into that when we're not sure if that would be a possibility, versus if you give us direction that we could at least explore, then it's worth time and energy for a staff of three people, I might remind you, and very limited dollars to this program. We just would like to be able to at least explore the options and talk further with our partners in Washington State and see if there is a way that this is useful. It's not the first thing on our list of things to do, but it certainly just opens up the sidebars, realizing that you don't meet, but usually most every 2 years,
except for February. But
it's a short month.
I mean, personally, I think the decision to go into Medicaid with this program is a discrete decision that we should make, and we shouldn't just allow the option. It's a lot of this work with the health fund board and all this stuff is the question of who makes the ultimate decisions. Do we allow an agency the authority to make decisions that we should be making as the policy body? And I guess that's my concern with this. The exploration can take place now, and if the evidence shows that it's something that we should do or should request waivers for, then that's a discrete decision that we should be making, not allowing them to make the decision for us. And when you look at this original bill, what it was designed for was to bring small rural standalone pharmacies into the mix, so that they weren't so contracts could be made there. And now we've morphed it into this other thing. So I have a problem with that.
Okay. Yes.
Now we're looking at the -1 amendments.
Yes.
And I just we went through the whole thing again, and it the administrator may, the following individuals or entities may participate. It's the administrator may, and so it was all changed from shall to may throughout the whole. So to me, it's much more acceptable this way rather than mandating it at this point. That you will.
Okay. Other comments? Yes, Senator Berger.
I guess my only comment is that certainly changing it from shall to may changes the fact that you're not dictating to them to do it. On the other hand, if you say you may do it, that's the same as saying go right ahead. I know you say it's not the first thing on your list. I'm going to kind of watch and see if it's been the first thing on your list, because I think that I'm troubled by that a little bit, and I would hope that you would only use that in a very discretionary way. But it is not of such a deep concern to me that I would oppose the bill today in the committee. However, I do have to tell you that it's pretty clear to me that what you're saying is you've given me the the authority to do this or to go on, your permission, your blessing, if you will, and we appreciate that, but that's not really our intent. And I'm taking you at your word that that's what that is, that it's not your intent. So.
Okay. Other comments? Okay, thank you very much. We have the Dash 1 amendments.
Are we in work session?
Yes, we're in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 735.
Okay, the Dash, Senator Mona Sanderson moves the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 735. Discussion? Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, just back to the point I was making, this needs to be a, if indeed we're going to move into Medicaid, and there's no other reason for this except to explore that, there's concerns about would this potentially put restrictions on Medicaid as far as dealing with chronic or mentally ill patients, things like that, which is why I think ultimately this we should not be giving an agency the discretion. We should, and they can currently make all of the explorations they want, but I think this sort of move is rather dramatic, and it's a discrete decision that should be made by the legislature, not by an agency.
Okay. Other? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of a like mind with Senator Cruz, I would feel more comfortable actually approving a statute or a change in statute when I knew what the end result was and what it was specifically doing, and allowed to review and talk about unintended consequences or bigger picture. Mm-hmm. There's just so many unknowns in my mind that I feel uncomfortable actually changing statute when we really don't know what the end result really is. So, I'm all in favor of reducing the cost of health care, whether it be one form or another, but there's just too much unanswered question here right now, so I will be voting no.
Okay. What other comments? Yes.
We have the highest unemployment that we've had since the early 80s, and we are now hearing anecdotally the fact that there are people not being able to buy their medications. They've either lost their jobs or they're gone to halftime. I think we have a moral obligation to look at discount purchasing programs and seeing how we can help our people, our Oregonians who are struggling. And so that's why I really don't have a problem with getting this. I think we would not be doing service to those who can't afford to buy their medications.
Thank you. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Monahan?
Yes.
Senator Berger?
Yes.
Senator Kelper?
No.
Vice Chair Cruz?
No.
Chair Morrison?
Yes. Okay, Senate Bill 735 will move to the Senate floor.
No, the amendment.
Oh, the amendment. Okay, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 735 as amended to the floor. And does this, forgot what FSRA is?
No.
To the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Senator Mona Sanderson moves Senate Bill 735 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Further discussion?
As amended.
Further discussion? Yes, Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I was fully supportive of the original bill because I do think the original bill dealt with one of the unintended consequences of the program, and that was the standalone pharmacies. And I would have been supportive of the amended bill if we had included the Dash 2 amendments to make sure that any discrete decision involving federal programs in this program were left to the Legislative Assembly.
Okay. Thank you. Further discussion? Okay. Would you call the roll, please?
Senator Monash
Anderson? Aye.
Senator Berger?
Aye.
Senator Telfer?
No.
Senator Cruz?
No.
Senator Morrison?
Aye. Okay, now, Senate Bill 735 will move to the floor of the Senate with a due pass with my due pass recommendation. And yes, I will carry it. And will there be a minority report?
I'd like to serve notice of potential minority.
Thank you. I appreciate that because it wouldn't be the same without it. Yes. Same song.
Third verse.
Fourth verse. Okay. Close the public hearing and move.
Work session.
The work session and move to Senate Bill 649. We will open a public hearing.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 649 was originally heard on March 16th. It requires drug manufacturers and wholesale drug outlets to adopt a marketing code of conduct, provide and conduct training, and perform an annual audit and report information to the State Board of Pharmacy annually. The board will report the findings by March 31st of each regularly scheduled legislative session. We do have a -1 amendment, which modifies the provision in the measure from the term audit to self-audit by the manufacturer to wholesale drug outlet. And we have received the revenue and fiscal impact statements on the -1 amendment.
Okay. Tom Holt, Jim Gardner, my two favorite pharma people.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Tom Holt, here today representing Eisai, which is a biotech company, here in support of Senate Bill 649. And we appreciate the opportunity to have worked with you on developing this bill and the -1 amendment. This bill describes essentially a process where companies like Eisai would file with the State Board of Pharmacy a copy of their internal marketing compliance policies, as well as how they enforce those policies, and then attest annually that they do a self-audit. And that's the amendment, is to insert the word self to clarify that we're not talking about an accounting style of audit, but rather that there is internal policing of the policies. And while not specifically described in the bill, by name, the Section 2.1a in its verbiage essentially describes the only industry code of conduct that I'm aware of, and that would be the pharma code that is pretty extensive and was updated most recently this last summer. And is fairly restrictive. I believe the committee's been provided with copies of that some time ago. I hope you've had an opportunity to review that. This bill is modeled on a Nevada statute, in which in a prior life I happened to have been involved in developing. It's worked fairly well there, and we would urge the committee's support.
Jim Gardner, representing Pharma. As Tom indicated, this is modeled on the Nevada law, seems to have worked well, and I haven't seen the FISRIS, but I'm assuming this is probably...
See, people are using it.
It's a new, wonderful phrase we use in all of every committee building. But I'm guessing that this is probably the least impactful in terms of all of the various disclosure restrictive bills that are out there. So we think that the code works well by itself, but of the bills, this is certainly the we think the most workable.
Senator Mark, or Representative Mark.
Thank you, Mr.
Everybody's Chair. A senator when you're a senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Representative Ron Howard, serving House District 3, Mr. Jessamine. And I am here testifying, actually just to lend my comments to this conversation based on my experiences in ownership of a very small rural health clinic and the relationship that we had with the pharmaceutical detailers, the representatives that came to our clinic. And to describe the changes very briefly that we've seen over the course of the time we've owned the clinic, which we sold March 1st, so I no longer am in the business, so I'm less conflicted than I was a month ago. But over the last 7 years, the relationship between the detailers and the providers, and of course this is in a very small clinic, I don't know what the relationship is in larger clinics, but in our clinic it changed. Every year the detailers had stricter requirements how they could interact with the providers, and they were very cognizant of that relationship because they could see the changes. When we first took over the clinic in 2001, it was very common to have multiple meals two or three times a week. We came in just after the trips stopped, and that was, you know, unfortunately for us, we didn't go on any you know, junkets to Bermuda or whatever. Those were all gone. And I think at that point there was clearly the pressure, the public pressure, to change that relationship was pretty strong. And at some point, I can't remember, I want to say 2005, I could be wrong, the federal government said, industry, you will either straighten up or we will fix it for you. And at that, I mean, it was clear over the course of a couple months that relationship changed even further. It has changed in the last year. We used to get stacks of pens, no pencils, but lots of pens. Well, that clinic is no longer receiving pens because they don't give them anymore. And so what a terrible shame. But the point is that the industry has responded to public pressure, and I think more to pressure from bodies like this, from states, but also from the federal government. And my preference is to allow that public pressure to continue to be the mechanism by which things change, to allow the industry to respond to that public pressure, which I think is completely appropriate. I think it's inappropriate for a governmental agency to reflect the public interest and ask an industry to change their ways. And in fact, they have. So, there are several bills being considered, and I think the Pharma Code, the little gray book that I think you have, is good. I mean, I don't mind having the conversation, but ultimately, reporting gifts, limiting those, actually doesn't limit gifts, it just says reporting gifts, I think are probably too far to go. I do have concerns between the relationship with clinical trials and pharmaceutical companies and how that interaction works, just as a public person. I don't know how those interactions work, and that would be of more concern to me than a detailer and how they work with a family practice physician or even an internist. So I will limit my testimony to that and answer any questions if you had any.
Senator Monsanderson, you might want to respond to the clinical trial. We heard a bill concerning clinical trials and pharmaceutical industry. Are we going to continue? Did we?
You passed it.
We did pass it.
We did pass it.
Mm-hmm. That did. Mm-hmm.
But that had to do with reimbursement more than ethics.
Well, to me, that's.
Yeah, and Mr. Chair, I mean,
important parts of the clinical trials is
one thing that has changed is that the physicians, when they comment in public about, you know, supporting a particular pharmaceutical, is disclosure of their ties to that company, and I think that clearly is in the public interest that is done. But there's another financial side is we have to be careful that we don't do something that's going to limit investment in the state of Oregon because we passed some stupid law that requires disclosure and therefore sends a biotech company who, you know, is flush with cash and wants to invest in the state of Oregon for whatever reason because we passed a law and they say, well, let's go to Washington or let's go to California or any other state where the rules are a little less restrictive. So I think we need to be very careful that we don't do something that is so far-reaching that, that actually is a financial detriment to the state.
Questions?
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the giving us the Pharma Code of Conduct, which is incredibly comprehensive. I mean, amazingly comprehensive, and I found it very informative and also very comforting. So I do think the industry has been self-policing in an incredibly positive way. And I think to a degree, the passage of this bill will just highlight that, that oversight that they've given themselves.
Further comment, the industry is very easy to vilify. But I also think that over the last couple generations, there's been a whole lot of great benefit come out of what they have produced. And in a lot of cases, only in America could that happen.
In most cases, only in America.
In most cases. I'm not going to say that there are a lot of other countries not doing a lot of really great things, but the U.S. clearly is on the forefront. And so I just say tread lightly as we go forward. Because, you know, how much have we spent? What's the increase in the pharmaceutical expenditures over the last couple of years as far as health care costs? The increase in pharmaceutical spending last year, I believe, was about 4.7%, give or take. But those increases have substantially subsided. And a lot of it has to do with the decreased pipeline of pharmaceuticals that are being researched, because the low-hanging fruit of the past 50 years have all been picked. It is now getting more and more difficult to come up with new pharmaceuticals. Very expensive processes, and so, you know, we can say, okay, enough is enough, and we won't find out anything else or come up with any new ideas. But I don't think long-term that's either good for us or in our DNA to say we're done. So thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions, comments? Senator Cruz.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the fiscal on it, and it will be absorbed by the board, but some things that concern me, and one of them at this point in time is, you know, costs may include attorney general fees to review administrative rules, and I'm thinking that's overkill, pure and simple overkill, that we have to have an AG opinion on administrative rules. It's absurd. So I think the cost estimate in the fiscal statement is overstated, because really all the Board of Pharmacy's got to do is collect data. So I'm not sure how in the world they come up with $74,000. So that is a concern to me. So,
well, Mr. Chair,
yes,
yeah, I was going to wait for work session to comment on that, but the $74,000 will come from other funds, and that's fee driven, and it says it does need staff to develop annual notice, receive and review documents, and develop the biannual report. And I know how much time it does take to then get that report to the legislature. And then they had postage printing and forms could be $10,000. I don't have a clue if that would be, but I think we need to be very careful about sending things to the floor when we're in this kind of economic straits.
Mr. Chair, if I just one more comment.
Yes.
And when I'm looking at the other things we're tasking the Board of Pharmacy with this session, okay, how many things are we going to task them with is a considerable issue. You know, PMP is a huge undertaking.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if I had to choose between the two, I would choose that one. But, you know, at the end of the day, you know, if we left things at status quo, we'd still be okay. So, you know, of the bills attacking the pharmaceutical companies as far as reporting, this is the best one of the bunch. in my opinion, but I am slightly concerned of what we are doing to a very small agency that we have. We are going to issue a very large body of work with the prescription monitoring program, which is absolutely critical. So it's just a concern.
Okay. Other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing and not open a work session because there is another... What?
Yeah, I'd like some more definition on
it. Yeah, we're okay. Going to... and besides that, the co-chair of the... Health Ways and Means Committee has a bill also.
This one's better, though.
I know.
Okay.
But there is another bill that is being worked on. There is another amendment to it, and we should have that soon, and we will hear that bill. And then this bill has already had a public hearing, and we can decide which bill, if any, we want to move to Ways and Means and let the co-chair of Ways and Means decide which bill is better and whether or not to fund it. So with that... we will, we've already closed the public hearing, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 716. Mm-hmm. You want to give us a brief description of Senate Bill 716?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 716, the original bill directed the Department of Human Services to adopt rules requiring immunization against meningococcal disease as a condition of attendance at school. There is a dash one amendment which basically replaces the whole bill. It replaces all the existing language in the measure. The amendment stipulates that the Department of Human Services, in consultation with the Superintendent of Public Instruction, shall prepare information about meningococcal disease for schools and post-secondary educational institutions to distribute. The information shall be made available at no cost and no later than June 1st of each year. It provides specifics on what the information must include, and the amendment mandates that the school must provide the parents of a child attending the school with the information at the beginning of every school year, starting when the child enters grade 6. Post-secondary educational institutions that offer on-campus housing shall provide the information to each entering student who will be residing in on-campus housing.
Okay. Sarah, would you come up, please? Well, go ahead. We'll just hear your testimony. Introduce yourself, please.
Chair Morissette, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Sarah Michael, Deputy Director of State Government Affairs with Santa Fe Pasteur. Our company produces Menactra, a meningococcal immunization, which was licensed in 2005, and it is recommended by the Centers for Disease Control's Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices, the American Academy of Pediatricians, and the Academy of Family Physicians as a routinely recommended adolescent immunization since that time. To give you a little background on the disease, the incidence
Mr.
is
Chair,
low.
Could Sarah move the microphone?
Thank you,
Sarah. Thank you. As I was saying, just to give you a little background on the disease, the incidence is low, but the onset is very abrupt and rapid. You can have a very healthy adolescent one evening just complaining of a headache or flu-like symptoms, and unfortunately can pass away in 24 to 48 hours. And we find the case fatality rate five times higher among adolescents 15 to 24 years of age, though the actual incidence for that age group is a little lower. One in five of the people who come down with meningitis suffer permanent sequelae or complications such as amputations, scarring, hearing loss, or neurological damage. The intent of Senate Bill 716 is really to put parents in a position to make an informed choice whether or not this immunization is appropriate for their child. Most physicians do recommend this immunization, but the problem is with adolescents is getting them into that physician to have the discussion about whether or not it is appropriate for that child. And that's the intent of having the material sent home from the schools, is to get that information in the hands of the parents. There is information out there available on websites. DHS has some very good information, but it's hard for parents to keep up with the national recommendations and immunization schedules. It changes year on year, so to expect them to search out that information, it might be a bit of a reach, but if we can get it to them so they can then go to their physician if they want more information and have that discussion, we feel they'd be able to make a better choice. This information, we want to be able to get to parents in the easiest mode possible, maybe piggybacking something the school's already sending home. It'd be very brief, one page. Again, the material is generally already out there and been created by DHS. And so it could perhaps go home in the school registration packets or something of that nature. We feel this bill is necessary in Oregon because, according to our data, it ranks 43rd in the nation for utilization, so about 29% of the kids have received this immunization. And Oregon is one of a few states left where there is no legislation for any age group on this immunization. And again, because of the rapid onset, where you're going to have a healthy child literally one evening and 24 to 48 hours later, it can be fatal, we feel immunization is the best option to protect against the disease, even though it is not does not have the highest incidence as compared to other immunizations. It's just the nature of the ability to treat it, it is what really makes a difference. And the ACIP, who sets the national standards for recommendations around immunizations, did look at this issue, that it does not have, high incidence as other routinely recommended vaccines, but they vetted that all out, looked at the research and data, and decided that it was on par with other things that are available, and it should be equally recommended. There is one other part or situation unique to Oregon, and that is that serogroup B, which has a higher than the national average incidence in this state, is not covered by the vaccine. But there is no vaccine available for serogroup B at all, and the overall incidence of disease, just for all the serogroups that the vaccine covers, it is higher in Oregon. So we still feel putting parents in a position to make an informed choice, or at least enter into the discussion with their physician, is worth it to protect those that the vaccine does cover. So for those reasons, we'd ask for your support on this bill.
Thank you. Sharon, stay right there. I'm going to call up Chuck Bennett, who has always supported anything that I have introduced. My bills have always found favor with Chuck Bennett. Always. Without exception.
Mr. Chairman, Chuck Bennett with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And so as not to disappoint you, Mr. Chairman, we go right along with what you're saying. This is number two this week. I'm feeling pretty good. Mr. Chairman, I do feel that we often are in front of committees concerned about cost of issues and adding to the burdens of school districts. And in reading this bill, Mr. Chairman, I think it's important that if we're going to show up and tell you it's cost too much and it's too big a hassle, when it's not costing too much, when the impact is de minimis in terms of cost or school time, we ought to make the same effort. So I wanted to come in front of you today to tell you we believe the impact of this bill as written, and in looking quickly at the amendments, it's a de minimis impact to school districts. The health benefit we believe to be, as we do in a whole range of other health-related issues, important. The information is supplied to us. I think the work involved is literally putting it into the packet that goes home, placing it on our website or into our student handbook. It's written by someone else. It's planned by someone else. The information comes from someone else. The brochure comes from someone else. We can, even in these hard economic times, make time to provide this kind of information. So no problem with this bill, Mr. Chairman.
What?
I know. I just love to watch your face when I get to do this. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Yes.
Is it Sarah? Yeah. Have you gone through, we have an extensive process
through the Department of Human Services. They have an immunization advisory committee, and they are the ones that we rely on to make recommendations because they have a whole lot more knowledge than we do about immunizations. They're able to look at the studies. They're able to analyze the impact here. And so I know that the department, the advisory committee, I assume hopefully they'll come tell us, have looked at this, but have you participated in that process?
When we were looking at an immunization requirement, we had reached out to them regarding that, and they invited us to join their group. And they had said, though, and I'm sure they could speak to this, my understanding is that they had already looked at the issue. They didn't feel it was necessary, so we were kind of impasse.
We'll hear why.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good. Thank you very much. Thank you. Okay, Lorraine Duncan, Ann Thomas, and Gary and Dean, would you come up, please?
Chair Morissette and committee members, my name is Lorraine Duncan. I'm the Immunization Program Manager for the Public Health Division, Department of Human Resources. Mm-hmm. And we have Ann Thomas here from, she's a physician with Acute and Communicable Disease Section to talk about the disease, meningococcal disease in Oregon, if you have questions about it.
Okay.
I'm here to talk about the Senate Bill 716-1 amendments, which ask us to work with the superintendent of schools to provide information and then for the schools to distribute that information. We have a zero fiscal impact because it's our understanding that we could provide the information, a PDF, to the schools and that they would print it and distribute it. The immunization program is happy to work with our partners, the Department of Education, on these materials. We have them developed. We think we do a really good job already about working with the community on the information about vaccine-preventable diseases. Our job for the state immunization program is not to do one vaccine at a time, but to promote all vaccines for childhood, adolescents, and adults. So that's basically how we approach our immunization responsibility around education. I handed several examples of some of the educational materials that we have. And the first one is this form called the Vaccine Information Statement. It's kind of a purple-colored form. So these are, we call the vaccine information statements, and they're provided on all the 16 diseases for that are vaccine preventable. They all have the same format. So they include, you know, what is the disease, what's the vaccine recommendation, who should get the vaccine, who shouldn't get the vaccine, are there risks with the vaccine, and then a little information about more information if you're interested. So we provide thousands of these in 30 different languages to anybody who asks. We provide them free to all the public clinics, and we provide a camera-ready copy for all the private physicians. In addition to that, we promote science-based websites. So there's a little flyer in there that's called Resources for Science-Based Immunization Information. And there's six sites listed. They all include a huge amount of information about all the vaccine-preventable diseases, including the meningococcal. We provide to all physicians' office a little book called the Flip Book. And it looks, I brought one, and I hope it's being passed around so you can see it. But basically, it's in many different languages, so it's English on one side and a different translation of another language on a different page. And so this is the page about meningitis. The acute and communicable disease section and the immunization section have an extensive website about adolescent immunizations. Our site talks about vaccinations, and the acute and communicable disease site talks about the disease and how to protect against that. And we've recently updated that. And the web link to that is included in the testimony on the back side. In addition to that, I think many of you are familiar with this form. It's called the Certificate of Immunization Status. This is the form that's provided to all of the schools for the parents to document their immunizations. And you'll notice the first page is all the required vaccines. And then on the inside, it shows all the recommended vaccines. And the plan is always that we provide the vaccine information statements in the school handbook every year so that if there's a question that comes up at the school, either about a required vaccine or a recommended vaccine, that these vaccine information statements for all 16 diseases are included in that document. So I'd just like to close in saying that we are very interested in providing education. We don't think this is necessary for the schools in that it's provided in every physician's office, every public clinic in the state. There's ample information available on the website, and we think that it's covered. We're worried that additional information home to the parents, when they keep getting more and more information, there's less chance that they're going to read it. And if you had any questions about the disease in Oregon, Dr. Thomas would be happy to answer your questions.
Mm-hmm. Questions?
Yes, yes, Mr. Chair. In Sarah Michael's testimony, she said that Oregon ranks 43rd in the nation for utilization, 29% of this immunization. And do we have stats for... I was looking... at something I got in April 15th, 2008, on meningococcal disease, and it says that and I don't understand all of this regarding PCV7 uptake. Is that referring to a certain meningococcal
vaccine? That's actually pneumococcal conjugate vaccine.
So
I'm
that's
not sure.
Pneumococcal, and right. We're on meningitis. Forget it.
Thank you.
But it's another source of meningitis.
Yeah, right.
Say your name for the record.
I'm Dr. Ann Thomas. I'm a public health physician with the Acute and Communicable Disease Program in the Oregon Public Health Division.
Okay. Yes, Senator Telfer.
Thank you. I just want to clarify. Right now, you do not currently provide this information to the schools unless they request it, but you do put it in clinics and doctor facilities, and these are teenagers that may or may not go to be seeing a doctor on a regular basis. So.
Chair Morissette and Senator Telfer, that's correct. We provide all the information to public clinics and to private clinics. Currently, we provide the certificate of immunization status to schools, and starting next school year, we will include the important information forms on all 16 diseases in the school handbook. But that hasn't happened in the past. You're correct.
Okay.
The important point to remember is that we have a new school requirement this school year for a vaccine called Tdap, diphtheria, tetanus, acellular pertussis, that is an adolescent requirement. So adolescents are having, seventh graders, are having to go into a physician's office to get that vaccine. And that's at the time our physicians, public and private, are trying to do a really good job about promoting, the HPV vaccine for cervical cancer and the meningococcal vaccine. It's an opportunity that we didn't have before because they didn't have a required vaccine that they had to get. But starting this school year, that we do have a required vaccine. So they are having to go into a physician's office to get those vaccines.
Thank you.
And your contention or assertion about this particular effort is that too much information is confusing.
Senator Morissette, lots of times I've heard from parents that when they get huge amounts of information that they're less likely to read it. Ann was explaining to me that that's kind of her position when she gets packets home. And the problem is if we do this vaccine this year, the next year they might want one more, and if we have to do all 16, the chances of them reading any of it is probably not too likely.
So more is less in this case, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Okay, now I think I got the right information. I'm a meningococcal. I would like to know, first of all, is it required to get into college?
Senator Morissette and Mona Sanderson, it's not required to get into colleges. The only college requirement is a measles vaccine.
Okay. And just follow up. And from 1993 to 2007, we had 24 cases in college students, but it was vaccine serogroup 6C1Y, be that as may. When we give a vaccine, a meningococcal, will it cover all the serotypes of meningococcal disease? I sort of want to know if we say a person should have a meningococcal vaccine, does it cover every possibility of a meningococcal
Senator Morris and Senator Mona Sanderson, the current vaccine covers the serotypes A, C, Y, and W135. Half the cases in Oregon are B, which is not covered in the vaccine.
Okay, that's what I wanted to get at. So half?
Half
so,
the cases.
Wow. Okay.
Chair Morissette and Senator Mona Sanderson, just to go over the numbers for the college students. As you mentioned, there were in that 15-year period, there were 24 cases in college students, but there were only 14 in students attending four-year colleges who would have been subject to a vaccine requirement. Additionally, it's typically applied to sort of freshmen. And so we have the numbers that, I mean, it would have, out of those 14 cases, there were only, you know, And it's typically recommended for people living in dorms. I mean, it would have applied to like four students, and only two of those, and two of those were type B, which is not covered by the vaccine. So, like in a 15-year period, it would have prevented perhaps two cases in Oregon college students who would have been subject to a vaccine requirement.
Did those die? Did those two die?
Actually, the only two deaths during that period were due to serogroup B, which would not have been covered by the vaccine.
Wow. Okay.
Senator Morissette, maybe one important point to mention is that it's a pretty expensive vaccine, $76 a dose, and it's the least cost-effective of all childhood and adolescent vaccines. So.
Hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Gary?
Thank you, Senator Morissette. For the record, I'm Gary Andine, the president of the Oregon Independent Colleges Association. There are roughly 20,000 dormitory rooms or people living in private college dormitories in the state. If this law passes, we will certainly work with the department to make sure that whatever information is needed to be passed around does get passed around to those students. I did, we just learned about this bill yesterday, so I did a quick email to my health service directors on all the campuses, and what you have in front of you is the results of that. It's a single sheet and rather small print because I was just copying my email. I'll just read you two short pieces of that from the Director of Student Health Center at Pacific University over in Forest Grove. I have concerns about requiring yearly distribution of meningococcal disease information to college students living in residence halls, given that the vaccine does not cover the most prevalent strain that occurs in the Pacific Northwest. While we encourage parents to have their children immunized, we try to make it clear that immunization does not exempt a person from getting the strain most prevalent in this area. And then the second concern that she has is the information distributed would need to be very clear about the limitations of the vaccine so that students and parents can make an informed decision, along with a warning to continue to be aware of symptoms. There are administrative issues in distributing the information from a college perspective, and in addition, it seems there could be liability, i.e. a lawsuit if a student died of the illness and the parent did not receive the information from their student, or a lawsuit by a student who had lost limbs due to the disease who claims he or she did not receive the information. And then up at the top of the page, I just underline one note from the Lewis and Clark Health Service. I think we should strive to do this, but mandating it might leave us open for problems. I present this to you in a totally neutral position on the case. I just thought you should have that information from my health service people.
Thank you. Thank you, Gary. Alan. Morgan Allen. Morgan Allen. Identify yourself, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Morgan Allen with the Oregon Department of Education. And I wanted to come say a few words about this bill, and it's not often I disagree with my friend and colleague Chuck Bennett on legislation, and I agree with him that a lot of information already does go out to our school kids, and our school districts do a good job of providing all kinds of information on basic childhood diseases and illnesses like head lice, and, you know, all the way up to more serious things. But we have a couple concerns with this particular piece of legislation. As Senator Cruz knows all too well, being on the Senate Education Committee, our schools are looking at some pretty devastating budget cuts during the upcoming biennium, and some of the committees, like even the Senate Education Committee, are looking at ways to reduce the burden and mandates on our school districts. So, you know, this would be another sort of unfunded requirement on our school districts, although I would agree with Mr. Bennett, it's sort of a very minimal impact, but I think that needs to be played into the calculus. But a couple points I'd like to raise are that right now, this, I think this bill, and I checked with Cindy Hunter, our legal affairs coordinator, this would sort of be the first time we're putting into statute a specific disease and a specific layer or level of requirement and notification that would have to go to parents through the school district. So, you know, all the other common childhood diseases and all the other more serious childhood diseases would sort of not be in statute, and I believe this disease would, my understanding is, it would sort of stand alone in statute as something that school districts would have to give notification to parents about. I think the other concern is that we don't want to do, if the legislature wants to make a policy decision that we need to provide more information to parents via school districts about childhood diseases, that we need to do it in a comprehensive approach, not a piecemeal approach. You know, we don't want to see 10 or 15 or 20 bills over the next few sessions targeting specific diseases or specific strains of diseases. We would prefer that the legislature take a more comprehensive approach where you have the public health community, the school nurse community, you know, DHS, you know, Department of Ed, you know, the folks that make the vaccines, you know, come together more of like a work group and decide, okay, so if we're going to require school districts to get this information to parents, you know, what are the most critical things that they need to know about? So I think that's just a concern, is sort of the piecemeal approach to it. So I think we would reluctantly oppose the bill just because of sort of given the circumstances with our school districts and mandates, and given that it doesn't seem like, you know, a lot of the public health folks and the school nurses were really involved in this, and we would prefer a more comprehensive approach if we're going to put a statutory requirement on school districts to get information to parents. So I'd be happy to answer any questions and appreciate the opportunity to speak.
Okay, seeing no questions, thank you.
Thanks
very much, Morgan. Okay.
Mr. Chair, we have two letters, written statements in opposition to the bill. One from Jan Sanderson, who's a nursing supervisor with the Multnomah Educational Service District's Health and Social Services Program, and another from James K. Lace, who is the chair of the legislative committee at the Oregon Medical Association and at the Oregon Pediatric Society, as well as a local pediatrician with the Childhood Health Associates of Salem.
Okay. Good. Thank you. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 716, and we are adjourned.